Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna. Hej, välkommen till det allra första avsnittet av Hästveterinärerna. Jag som pratar heter Maria och den här podden är för dig som är hästveterinär eller djursjukskötare eller jobbar med hästsjukvård på ett eller annat sätt. Här kommer vi att träffa experter inom olika områden som är intressanta för dig som jobbar med just hästsjukvård. I det här första avsnittet kommer vi prata med Martin Kradup Nielsen vid University of Kentucky. Martins specialintresse är hästens parasiter och han är en väldigt flitig forskare som har publicerat över 200 artiklar. Jag träffade Martin när han besökte oss för att spela in ett par föreläsningar om parasitläget och om sjukdomar associerade till parasitangrepp hos häst. Och dessa två föreläsningar kommer sändas under hösten via vår plattform Vetportal. Där kommer de också finnas tillgängliga efter att de har sänds och du som är veterinär kan gå in på www.vetportal.se och läsa mer om hur du når föreläsningarna. Men för att få en försmak på innehållet så kan du bara lyssna vidare här på mitt samtal med Martin.
Welcome to the podcast, Martin.
Well, thank you very much.
So can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? What's your background? And what's your sort of horse owning experience? Do you have any? Are you a horse person to begin with?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. How much time do you have? Because I'm very much a horse person. I definitely grew up, in a life with horses, with my family. My parents had a stud farm with Icelandic horses. My mom ran a riding school for many years. She trained horses. We never went on vacations. We always spent our weekends and holidays going to shows, like competitions with Icelandic horses. So I kind of grew up in that community and was always interested in horses. And I tried to go into veterinary school. I tried to keep an open mind about, trying to remind myself that it might also be other animal species that could be interesting to work with as a veterinarian. But in the end of the whole thing, I just realized that you have to go with where your passion is. Yeah. And for me, that was definitely horses. I like animals in general, as many veterinarians would say. So it's not that. It's not that I dislike any of the other animals, but I was definitely more comfortable with horses and sort of the whole horse speak, how to speak with clients and all that. I found that a lot easier, how to handle horses and all that, just a lot easier because of the background naturally. Yeah. I got interested in parasites, which is, the question I always get is like, how on earth?
My next question actually.
How on earth did you end up working with parasites? So going to veterinary school in Denmark in the 1990s, one of the most active and the largest research groups at the time was the parasitology group. They had a large government grant, a basic foundation, research foundation grant that allowed them to establish a research center, Danish Center for Experimental Parasitology. And they had a bunch of PhD students. I think at one point they had 30 PhD students working on parasitology, various aspects of parasitology. And so as a veterinary student, there were so many opportunities to like get a little job and where you actually would get paid for doing relevant things and helping out with these projects. So I was one of many, many vet students who did so and got interested and introduced to parasites that way. At that time in the 90s, we had heard the bulletins of this change in legislation that was coming with the prescription only. And so shifting from over-the-counter availability of the anthelmintic products to having them restricted by prescription only. And as the listeners will be familiar with, that's the norm now 20 years later in Denmark and now also in Sweden and in principle also in Finland. And I think Norway as well. sometimes a little bit with differences in terms of how these laws are administered. But back in the 90s, it was a dramatic shift you know, having all the decisions be in the hand of the, in this case, the horse owner, but the pet owner, to now having it all funneled through the veterinarian, who would then oversee the decisions of parasite control and how to put together the right strategies. So that was very intriguing for me and a couple of my vet school buddies. I had a very good friend. We did a lot of projects together. Did one or two on just asking questions of how will this look like? How will parasite control be carried out under this legislation? And I think in many ways you can argue that over 20 years later, 25 years later, that's actually still what I'm working with in my research.
Yeah.
I graduated from the Danish veterinary school in 2001, spent 3 years in practice, primarily equine, but somewhat mixed, and had a great time, really liked many aspects of that job, especially all the client interactions and the fact that you never had 2 days look exactly the same, I think was very intriguing. But I had, I think, deep down somewhere this, you know, I don't know, interest or motivation for digging deeper into things, and which is hard in a practice life to do in many types of practices. So I knew that maybe this research whole thing was something that might appeal to me. Mm. I had sort of contemplated a little bit already while still in vet school that maybe PhD would be something for me. Interestingly, going into vet school, I didn't know what a PhD was, but you know, graduating from vet school, I kind of had an idea of what that might be. And that's what I did. I went back to school and pursued a PhD. And a very long story short, ended up in the U.S. And have been there for the past 11 years.
And so how did you end up there? You're in Kentucky now.
Yeah.
So was it the parasites who pulled you there?
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, so when I started my PhD, I knew I wanted to do equine. So something with equine parasitology. And I had some ideas surrounding diagnosing the bloodworm, Strongylus vulgaris. The big question I had was, you know, these restrictions in ethamidic usage, so treating much less than compared to before, would that come with a risk of a reemergence of Strongylus vulgaris?
Yeah.
So Strongylus vulgaris had largely disappeared from the radar when people were still deworming a lot and very frequently. But so the question I had was, would Strongylus vulgaris come back? Mm. And to address that question, I needed a good diagnostic, and there really weren't many good more modern type diagnostics for this parasite. So that's kind of what I wanted to do. But I started out in Denmark, and there was no one in Denmark doing equine parasitology. So I had some really good, very supportive and knowledgeable supervisors. Mm. One was a clinician. The other one was a parasitologist. Perfect combination. But neither of them had ever done any research with these questions. So I had to sort of find out where in the world there might be someone who actually had that knowledge. One thing is to read the papers and find out, okay, what has been published. But I think when you're deciding what to do for your PhD and finding the right project, you need to also know all the things that had been tried that never worked out.
Yeah.
And those things tend to not get published, right?
Yeah.
So I did some searches and, found a couple people, one particular in the U.S. who had done some diagnostic work with Strongylus vulgaris, and I contacted him, and he was in Louisiana, and he was like, sure, Martin, come on over. And, and he said, this was back in 2004, he said, yeah, you know, and while you're here, you might as well make a small circular travel around the southeastern U.S. because there's about three other people in this area that also do equine parasitology. So you might as well visit all four rather than just me. And so I was like, sure, okay. I'd never been to the U.S. before at that time. So I was like, I think I wrote him back and said, yes, sounds good. I think I'll just take the train. And he said, hey, Martin, there's something you need to know about the U.S. We don't have trains. You need to rent a car. Okay, okay. And so that's what I did. And that was very intimidating because I never you know, I found myself on these giant highways with eight lanes. You know, the fear of ending up in the wrong lane is very stressful.
Different to Denmark.
Oh my goodness. And then, you know, this was 2004. So, I did not have a navigator, a GPS. Mm. I had like this paper map that I had unfolded. It was in the passenger seat right next to me. I was trying to follow where I was going. But anyway, I guess career defining travel, because I ended up connecting with these four people.
Yeah.
That one of them, just the guy in Louisiana, just passed away this year, very sadly, but they all remained very important part of my network and became collaborators and supporters of my work. And I ended up deciding to spend some time of my PhD in the lab of one of these people in Georgia, Dr. Ray Kaplan, who is still a near and dear friend to me today. And he really became that subject matter supervisor that I needed, in addition to the support of the two others that I had, Susanne and Outtorp and Jesper Monner, that were great all the way through. So together, I now had the right backing team. Mm-hmm. And that's where the U.S. connection got established. One of those places was the University of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Gene Lyons, who I actually make a couple references to in my webinars. I had the fortune to, he was a living legend at the time. He now passed, but still a big, big legend in equine parasitology, and great to have an opportunity to work alongside him. So I visited him and saw the resources in Kentucky and thought, there's a lot of knowledge here. There's a lot of opportunities. Some of them are those horses that they keep, research herds that they kept since the 1970s. One of them has not been dewormed since 1979, and has a bunch of parasites as a result. And by the way, those horses are perfectly healthy. So that's an aside. But so there was a connection to Kentucky at the time. And I then subsequently, you know, got my PhD, defended it, graduated in 2007. I was fortunate to get a job at the University of Copenhagen as an assistant professor. Started working there. Then I was able to get a grant, a research grant. And one of the components of that grant was that you had to go and spend some time somewhere else as part of that two-year grant. And so I thought, okay, I've been to Georgia. That was great. Now what's next? I need to go somewhere else, but maybe probably still in the U.S. Mm. And that's what brought me to Kentucky and spend another 6-8 months or so. I forget how long we were there, but, you know, my family came with me all the time, both of those occasions. So we had another nice stay there in Kentucky. And that's doing a couple projects. It's still working on diagnosing the buttworm. And that's where they started the people in charge, countrymen of yours, Mats Trotsen, who was the chair of the department at the time in Kentucky and director of the Gluck Equine Research Center, asked me the question, hey, Martin, what are your career plans? And I said, you know, I'm assistant professor to Copenhagen. You know, think, you know, continue that path. And he said, well, have you thought about, you know, working in another country? And I was like, for example, here. And I said, you need to ask my wife. And so they did. So, you know, distinctly remember this dinner where my wife and my kids were there. They were little at the time. And then the people from the Gluck Center. And I told my wife, they're going to ask about this. You know, you just be prepared. They're going to ask the question. And we sat there. We had, entree, starters, and then the main courses, and then dessert. And we talked about various things, but that question didn't come up. And I was like, maybe I misunderstood. Maybe I was just overinterpreting. Maybe I was just being too hopeful there. And so they asked for the check, and I'm like, all right, that's it. We're about to leave. And as they signed the check and gave it back, and then we were about to just stand up and leave the table, and not Mats, but his associate said, oh, by the way, and leaned over to my wife and said, could you see yourself living in the U.S.? And my wife said, sure, I'll be ready for it. And he said, good. That was that discussion.
That was it.
And so that led to them creating a position that I then applied to.
Oh, wow.
Been there ever since. So, yeah.
Nice. Because, I mean, seems to be a lot of pros and cons about working in such a small sort of area. I mean, you're sort of almost alone in your field.
Yeah.
But there is so much more to discover.
Yeah.
And then you have all these other sort of gurus that are so devoted to this that you maybe don't have in a broader field. You know what I mean? That this is something that you really truly specialize in. And when you specialize, you get super expert. So very inspiring.
Yes. I mean, there's a couple of ways you can look at this. You can say, well, I am one of the leading experts in equine parasitology in the world, which is true, but it's mostly because there's really not that many of us. But by the way, so there used to be the four people that I visited back then, plus a couple additional ones. There used to be five or six people in just the U.S. all doing equine parasitology. Yeah. I am now the only one in the whole country, which is kind of, it's curious. It's interesting. It's sort of weird. So why is that? I mean, of course, they all either retired or some of them, as I mentioned, passed away. There should be more interest in doing more. There's so many outstanding questions, and it's actually nice to be the only one. You can say, you should support me because there's no one else. But it's also sort of a disadvantage that you don't have others to discuss things with and develop the new ideas with. Mm. And so it's also a critical mass question that, I think it takes its ups and downs, and sometimes it's just random things and that sort of leads to or decides how many people are working in a specific field. I think it's probably, as in my case, often driven by personal passion and interest. And it just happens to be so that right now I'm the only one, which is just kind of weird. I'm the only one in the entire North America. There's not anyone in, there's a couple people doing a little bit now in Canada, so to be fair. But I mean, I don't want to sound like there is no one else. But I think the other part of what you're saying is it's a very specific interest to have. And you have to be very fortunate to just come across a job that is so much a perfect fit. I don't think there's many other jobs in the world that are like, okay, we need someone who likes horses and wants to work with horses and parasites and do primarily research.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a dream job for me.
Yeah, that's nice to hear.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about some of your research questions. You touched upon the diagnosis of the Strongylus vulgaris, and it seems to have been an ongoing frustration. But you mentioned it also in one of your lectures that we're maybe onto something new with this NGAL. Can you tell us a little bit more about the not only this, but what's new in the topic and what can we sort of look forward to within this?
The most active group right now on these aspects, so clinically looking for biomarkers that might be either diagnostic or prognostic for this specific parasite. That's the group in Denmark led by Tina Peel and her students. And the NGAL marker that I mentioned in my talk is one of the things they've been doing recently. I don't have any involvement in this. I'm just a cheerleader on the sideline. I'm very excited to see them just continually exploring all these different possible markers. So they've done a number of different very interesting things. So they started out and they're still doing the whole coagulation cascade approach to basically asking, okay, so we have these big giant worms that end up in the bloodstream. So how does that affect clotting factors, et cetera? And are there any things in there that we can measure? And there's a PhD student now who just graduated, Marie Honoré, who did spend a little bit of time in my lab in Kentucky as well, but she graduated from Copenhagen. And that's what she worked on for her and did find some of these markers and was also certainly potential markers, I should say. But I think more importantly, she just characterized what happens in the blood when there's a worm in there, right? Mm. And one of the current students, Katrine Toft, who also spent a little bit of time. So there's in my lab. So there's a good collaboration there, but I don't want to take any credit for the work. What she's doing is also very interesting. So she's looking at microRNAs. And so, 20 years ago, and certainly when I started my PhD, nobody knew what that was. But microRNAs are just, as the name implies, short, really short strands of RNA that is, that are secreted by the parasites, often released in these vesicles. And sometimes there's a whole, you know, package of different items in there, various proteins, various bioactive molecules, and then including some of these microRNAs. These microRNAs may actually do specific things. There are these hypotheses that they are playing a role in modulating the host immune response to the parasite. Some of them may actually mimic microRNAs that are produced by the host, in this case, the horse. So they're sort of sneaking another one in there that does almost the same, but not quite the same. And that is one way to sort of modulate whatever that cascade is doing. And so what Katrine is doing there is looking for anyone that might have diagnostic potential. And she has a poster at an upcoming conference here in 2022, a parasitology conference, where she's showing, presenting some of the first work on, you know, microRNAs that are derived from the parasite and microRNAs that are derived from the horse. And then, are there any of these microRNAs that they can find in blood samples? And the answer is yes, they can.
Oh, wow.
So now the question is, so they can detect these and they're parasite derived, but are they specific to Strongylus vulgaris? Or might they be similar to ones that are maybe produced by some cyathostomus? So those are outstanding questions, but certainly some very important findings and very exciting. So those are things that are up and coming. The NGAL, I don't know anything about it. It's just one, I think an enzyme or some kind of marker that they were able to measure both in the blood and in the peritoneal fluid. In the peritoneal fluid, they found the concentration significantly elevated in horses that had the non-strangulating intestinal infarction, which is the condition that Strongylus vulgaris is causing. So, so that's some very interesting work that I think is definitely worth following, and some really key findings that they've made already.
Yeah, super interesting.
Yeah.
This would mean that you would basically erase the problem with the Strongylus vulgaris, right? Because if you could diagnose it before it causes any harm, then you could deworm, or how would it function? I mean, in what stage would you actually find it, and would you be able to do something about it before it creates the harm?
I think we're on a learning expedition here. So, you know, one thing is that we can detect the parasite while in the bloodstream. One of my former students, Ulla Andersen, developed an ELISA to do so. So we can do that. But when does it lead to the disease? For the most part, all the larvae cause the arteritis and the thrombosis, but in only rare occasions do we see that infarction that is really the problem. So what are the factors, and are there any markers that we can use to monitor that? And yes, then, you know, where do we sort of stop? You know, what's our level of tolerance? Do we actually tolerate the parasite being around? I don't think we can really feasibly eradicated anyway, at least not without inducing a whole lot of drug resistance that we already have a lot of in the other parasites. So do we tolerate the parasite, or do we have any kind of markers that then would inform us on the risk of the disease happening that only happens in a subset of horses? So I think we're learning more about the biology of the parasite and the disease and how these, you know, the parasite and the host interacts. And I think that's always useful information. I think we really need, as a scientific discipline, we need to go beyond just finding the next best treatment. Like, and then, you know, let's wipe them out. Let's just, you know, bombard them, chemical warfare. We need to sort of ask the questions that go beyond that. What is the next best treatment? And I think the group in Copenhagen are really doing an excellent job there.
Thank you so much for attending to this podcast. In the next episode, we will be talking a little bit about the differences between where you are right now, US, and where you're from, the Nordic countries and so on. But until then, thank you and see you soon.
Thank you.